This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
The way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible, but in the end they always fall. Think of it. Always.
They seem invincible. But in the end, they always fall. Always. A quote from Mahatma Gandhi.
And now for something completely different.
The Arctic is burning as never before. Scientist Jennifer Balch introduces new climate fast fires. Reports from the North Firefront, a panel on Arctic wildfires at the Arctic Circle Assembly in October. Changes in the Arctic change the world, but it is a lawless land. Joint action in the Arctic is in a coma, with military in the wings. In fire and heat, natural violence is taking over all around the polar sea. Look north. I'm Alex Smith. Welcome to Radio EcoShock. In 2023, wildfire season in Canada burned an estimated 18.4 million hectares of land, which is over seven times the annual average of 2.5 million hectares. Everyone is in shock. This total area burned was larger than the entire state of North Dakota, about 70% of the population of Canada's Northwest Territories was evacuated, including residents of the territorial capital, Yellowknife. It was the horror year four fire in the Canadian North. Future fires will be measured against this record-smashing blackening of vast lands with clouds of carbon released into the atmosphere. Experts are still gasping and grasping what it means. In June 2024, intense wildfires above the Arctic Circle in Russia's far north, particularly in the Sakha Republic, released about 6.8 megatons of carbon into the atmosphere, third highest on record. Research published in September of this year demonstrated that the rise in Siberian wildfires is related to drought, drying soils, and decreased rainfall caused by Arctic warming. The study identified a potential feedback loop where wildfires suppress precipitation, further drying soils, and increasing fire likelihood. A study published in Nature Communications revealed that Arctic wildfires are causing unprecedented permafrost thawing and soil drying, leading to that destructive cycle of more intense fires. Researchers estimate burned acreage throughout Arctic areas will more than double as permafrost thaws. With the Arctic warming four times faster than the rest of the world, we need dialogue and cooperation among the nations who claim those Arctic lands and waters. The flimsy institutions trying to make that happen are dying or dead. You will hear from half the Arctic in this program. What is it like to live there now? New threats arise as we are lost in the human sideshow of greed, war, and politics. We investigate two more feedback loops forcing still more warming in the Arctic. First, introducing a new class of fires that hurts us most.
In your tracks of Arctic flame.
The news is still full of wildfires. Vast areas burn, releasing more carbon into the atmosphere. Health-wrecking smoke travels thousands of miles away. But if you live in a fire zone, there is a new class of fires, beasts that maybe cannot be stopped. And where is the new fire zone in climate times? Apparently, it includes New Jersey and New York City in November. A new study uncovers a type of fire that burns thousands of homes and kills more people. Jennifer Balch is Associate Professor of Geography at the University of Colorado, Boulder. Her latest paper is The Fastest Growing and Most Destructive Fires in the U.S. 2001 to 2020. Jennifer Balch, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me.
They say climate change is what happens to you while planning for something else. What have experts and our fire rating system missed until now?
We've been so focused on megafires and the size of wildfires that we've forgotten probably the most important aspect of fires for life safety and homes, which is their speed. We delineated a new class of fires called fast fires and determined how fast is too fast in terms of the number of structures destroyed. And it turns out that fires that grow more than 4,000 acres in a day are the ones that destroy structures and homes. And the ones that destroy more than 100 homes during a wildfire, those grow more than 21,000 acres in a day.
And that's about 1,600 hectares for our European listeners. So talk to us about changes in wildfires now compared to the 1980s and 90s. Are they different?
They are, and there's been a lot of work in the fire science community showing that fires are getting bigger, fires are getting more intense, they're getting more severe, and we're now the first to also add that fires are also getting faster. They're getting faster across the West, 250% faster in just a couple of decades. And in California, they're 400% faster in just a couple of decades.
That's amazing stuff. I know that science often has to settle for long-term averages and statistics. How was your team able to spot events that develop in just one day and might disappear days later?
Yeah, we are experts at using satellite imagery to see fires and track them through time. And we developed an algorithm that essentially reconstructs how fires spread and how they grew over time on a daily basis. And so it was with that technology that we were able to determine for 60,000 wildfires how they grew and moved over time.
I see PBS Terra made a decent documentary about your new science, and in it, host Maya May says, quote, "As the wind drops in elevation, atmospheric pressure increases, which dries and warms the air. Temperatures can increase by as much as 5.5 degrees Fahrenheit for every 1,000 feet of lost elevation." That is a lot to understand. Can you describe these downslope fires, which PBS suggests may be unstoppable?
Yeah, that's a phenomenon that we see wherever we have mountainous terrain, and we have different names for those types of winds in different regions. So they call them the Santa Anas in Southern California. We call them the Chinooks here in Colorado. They're also called sundowners. The basics of it are that as winds move downslope, they are essentially hotter and drier as a function of a change in elevation. And they can also move quite quickly as well. And so those types of winds are winds that are really challenging in a fire scenario because they shift the firefighting capacity from suppressing the fire and putting out home ignitions to life safety and evacuation and getting people out. We experienced that here in Colorado. California has experienced it. Lahaina has experienced it as well. And so we do need to be aware of where we're building homes into landscapes that have a propensity for these types of winds.
Yeah, the Marshall Fire in Colorado, December 30th, 2021, it destroyed 1,000 homes in 6 hours. It's the worst in state history. Could you describe what happens when a fast fire arrives? How do people and firefighters respond?
Yeah, well, that one was right in my backyard, less than a mile from my own house, and it was a pretty devastating event for our community. That fire started in an open space system, a grassland system, and there were 110-mile-an-hour winds happening that day. We all knew that there were going to be high wind conditions. You know, unfortunately, there were fire ignitions in the mix, and that's what started these grassland fires. from human-related causes. That fire took off in the open space in grasses and essentially became a couple miles of active fire line moving through the open space and then hit neighborhoods on the eastern side of the foothills or the Rocky Mountains here in Colorado and started neighborhoods on fire through, a lot of ember ignitions. Wood fencing started on fire, wood siding started on fire, and then it became really an urban conflagration where a Chuck E. Cheese was evacuated, Costco was evacuated, there was a hotel that burned down, it jumped, major multi-lane freeways because of the ember cast across really large distances. It fundamentally changed how I conceive of the wildland-urban interface, essentially where homes intermix with flammable vegetation. And under high wind conditions, we can get fires in anything that will burn, even in suburbia.
Yeah, the public thinks forest fires, but you find more homes are lost in grassland fires, and then now we have urban fires.
That's right. We found that the most of the fast fires are actually happening in grassland system, which makes sense. And part of the reason why is because grasses are really fine, flashy fuels. They dry out really quickly. They catch on fire really quickly. And it's very easy for fire to move through them. We kind of have these images of smoky bear in the forest, but really the fires that are destroying our homes are the ones that are happening in grassland systems where it's very hard to suppress those fires, given how fast they move.
And the hellish fire that burned through the town of Jasper, Alberta last summer was also driven by heavy winds. The park and the whole town were evacuated within hours of it starting. That it had to be. And I wonder if that was another fast fire, and will you explore this new class of danger in other countries?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, we've made publicly available the data set that we derived from satellite imagery for the whole globe. So we will continue to pursue this question and better understand fast-moving events, particularly in the context of, I do worry about the next Paradise or the next Lahaina or the next Marshall Fire. I don't think we're going to see a future where we don't see more devastating events. And I would like the science to help inform, where do we expect communities to be most at risk from fast fires? Can we help prepare them or prepare our communities across the West where we have one way in, one way out towns, better prepare them for this type of risk in terms of their evacuation planning or in terms of how they're mitigating the risk proactively. The one positive upshot here is that we can do something about fire. We can build better. We can burn better. It costs the same today to build a conventional home as it does to build one that's fire resilient. And so we know that 80% of the wildland-urban interface is undeveloped, and so what we need to be thinking about right now is how we're building into flammable landscapes to shift this equation and this risk factor.
One other thing I think we need to point out to listeners, obviously a hotter planet and drought add to wildfire danger, but the increase in explosive fire is not only due to climate change. What else is playing into this phenomenon that we should look out?
Yeah, there's also fuels. So fire needs warm conditions, it needs fuel to burn, and it needs an ignition source. And so people are changing all three of those, and I've studied all three of those pieces. We know that across the U.S., the vast majority of ignitions are coming from human-related ignitions, whether they're accidental or whether they're infrastructure-related, like power lines. We also know that, we're changing fuels in the way that we fragment the landscape, in the way that we introduce invasive grasses, our road infrastructure. There are a lot of different ways that we're changing fuels for fire. And so part of it is, with fire suppression for many, many decades, in fact, a couple of centuries, we've removed, fire's role in reducing fuels in the landscape. And we try and mimic that through thinning, prescribed fire, other fuel mitigation efforts. But the challenge is that it's really hard to catch up with where we need to be in terms of fuel reduction and the way that fire used to work in our landscapes. You know, we do also need to mitigate the fuels around where people live. You know, I think it's important to focus those resources and energy where people live and work as opposed to in the middle of the woods where nobody is, given how hard and expensive it is. But that's part of the solution as well, is to think about the fuels. And also our homes are fuels too, and thinking about how we're building and what material we're building with, you know, whether we have wood decking or the roof fence on our homes. There's a lot of ways we can improve the fire resistance of our homes.
So we're talking about a tiny fraction of wildfires, maybe less than 3% of the 60,000 fires in your study, and yet these really are the ones to pay attention to and not necessarily the big ones. How is that changing the way fire suppression works, the way responders are having to operate?
Well, I think they're really challenging result out of our studies that we know fires are getting faster, so it's getting even harder to be a firefighter, and frankly we're asking too much of our firefighting community given that we're building homes in flammable places. We have a warming climate and then we expect them to put fires out. You know, I think more and more what it means is that firefighting communities are going to have to focus on the life safety aspect and the evacuation piece. But it's not just their problem. It's also, you know, at the level of communities and land use planning of, like, how do we incorporate that into thinking about future development? And, you know, are there enough exit routes? Are communities prepared to leave? Do they have enough information? Are warning systems, are they in place? Are they functioning in the way that we need them to be during an emergency? There's a lot of aspects to this problem. It's not just the firefighters putting it all on the shoulders of firefighters.
I live in a fire zone, and we don't have summers now. We have fire season. We just unpacked our bug-out bags a few days ago in November. And somehow we have to teach millions of people to believe in these warnings and to react more quickly than their parents ever had to. How can we improve the warning system and improve public reaction so we can deal with these very fast fires?
I think we need to target, first of all, where we expect fast fires to happen and understand limited community evacuation routes. And, you know, that's a west-wide problem because we also know that fast fires can happen pretty much anywhere across the West. It really does come down to where we expect high wind conditions, and high winds can be anywhere. So, you know, what that means is that we really need to prepare communities that have one way in, one way out towns, that expect to have, you know, high traffic scenarios in evacuation conditions and scenarios. And I don't think we're where we need to be.
Yeah, what was the resort town that had that one way in, one way out, and then they had a lot of trouble getting people in and out? Do you remember?
I'm not sure if you're talking about one this year, or, you know, I do know we had a scenario in Estes Park, which is just outside of, north of Denver, outside of Rocky Mountain National Park, a lot of visitation. So it could have very high population density based on the influx of tourists. And we had a very fast-moving event called East Troublesome Fire that jumped the Continental Divide through tundra and essentially, you know, bare soil over a mile and came bearing down on this town. And it was, you know, a traffic nightmare in that town. And fortunately, the weather and the wind shifted. But that was a very scary couple of days for that town. And it's, you know, emblematic of a lot of mountain towns across the West where, you know, we have a lot of people living in very, you know, dispersed, but fundamentally not as many road networks to get them out.
And this is based on hard data from NASA space monitoring and all kinds of ground-based fire records. And as you said, you found increases in fire behavior, like 250% more, almost 400% increase since just 2001. Could you talk to us about the impacts of climate change on fire behavior as you see it?
Yeah, it's a really great question, and we haven't tested yet the link between warmer temperatures and fire spread, but I can tell you that we expect that to be part of the equation, given that we know that fire responds really strongly to warming. In fact, it takes just a little bit of warming to lead to a lot more burning in terms of area. We know that it is expected to change intensities because more fuel is available. And that's been documented on a global scale, that we've seen an increase in intensity, and even at night as well, that some of our other work that looked at, we're losing the brakes on fire at night, as well as we've got our foot on the gas pedal during the day on wildfires. So we know that temperature increase has a big impact on fire behavior. And I do expect that with warming temperatures, with fuels being drier and more available, that would also increase the speed at which fires are moving.
What do you think you and your colleagues will be working on next?
Yeah, I think a big one is trying to understand where risk is highest in our western towns in terms of where we might expect to see fast fires and limited evacuation. So we really do want the science to be useful and to help inform our communities and help us better prepare.
From the University of Colorado, we've been speaking with Dr. Jennifer Balch. She is the lead author of the new paper, The Fastest Growing and Most Destructive Fires in the U.S. 2001 to 2020. You can find links to follow up in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Jennifer, thank you for sharing this new understanding of fire with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
What is it like to live in the fastest heating place in the world? Is that where the future of this whole planet will be written? We're about to listen to a panel with high-level speakers on what this barrage of wildfires in recent years means for the people in the Arctic, but also about a looming climate disaster if the boreal forest continues to burn. I'm going to tell you who the speakers are, but you will be surprised. These are not the bland platitudes you would expect. The speakers are Lisa Murkowski, United States Senator, Yvonne Jones, Parliamentary Secretary to the Canadian Minister of Northern Affairs and to the Minister of National Defense, Edward Alexander, Co-Chair, Gjøa Council International, Co-Lead of the Norwegian Chairship of the Wildlands Fire Initiative. We'll hear more about that. Maria Vartaresian, State Secretary, Ministry of Foreign Affairs, Norway. Normally, we just don't expect much from the official peoples, but none of that here. I was surprised when American Senator Lisa Murkowski spoke for everyone in the firing line from the far north to Carolina. We hear for the first time, for many of us, the real news from the Canadian Arctic. Edward Alexander gives us the experience of the original population of the Arctic, still there and still strong. And then a secretary of the giant petrol state Norway admits that burning fossil fuels is the main driver behind this burning in the north. This is, as you expect on Radio EcoShock, news you need to know. The panel discussion comes courtesy of the nonprofit group Arctic Circle. Don't confuse that with the politicians who represent 8 countries in the Arctic. That's the Arctic Council. And that's currently non-functional because of geopolitical issues. I'll tell you more about that in that breakdown in the Arctic later on. The first question goes to Senator Murkowski.
Unfortunately, summers in the interior particularly, have come to not be referred to as summer season, it's fire season. And a fire season means that even when the temperatures are finally comfortable and warm, your family may be inside because your children or your grandparents may have respiratory issues, or it's just not safe to be breathing the air. The soccer tournaments are canceled because it is not safe for the children to be out and engaging in vigorous exercise. It is a level of health safety, I think, that we think of first. In the interior, where I went to high school in Fairbanks, at that time, I didn't know a single person who had air conditioning, much less even a fan. And so your reality is we are dealing with an environment during the summertime particularly that has caused extraordinary concerns from a health perspective. It has been practice in Alaska over the decades with our extensive wildlands that the way that we handled the fires was the fires would burn unless there was threat to personal property or to families themselves. And then we would attack the fire. This past summer, as you noted, the amount of acres that were burned was relatively small. But where the McDonald fire was concentrated was right in the Fairbanks. It was in the metropolitan area. It was surrounding Eielson Air Force Base, Fort Wainwright, where significant populations live. So no homes were burned, but you literally had a community that was shut down, shut in. We're seeing not only the impacts to the people, but we're seeing the impacts to the land. When you have vegetation burn, and when you have, for instance, black spruce, which is the predominant spruce that is there, when they burn, they take a long time to recover. And what recovers then are the quicker growing trees that do not provide for the same level of protection for the permafrost when those trees are no longer there. So we're seeing a change in vegetation. So we're not only harming individuals with their health, but we're also exacerbating accelerated permafrost thaw, what that means from an accelerated carbon emissions. One last point, as my time is expired here. We in Alaska have, with our fires historically, seen about one half the nation's emissions as a consequence of these wildland fires. And yet just 4% of our fire budget country goes to Alaska. So we've got to flip that in terms of understanding what it means to better contain our fires, not only from a health perspective, but I'm hoping that my friend Edward will speak to what it means for just the health of the land itself and the animals and those who subsist upon it.
Parliamentary Secretary Jones, this spring, Canadian officials warned that 2024 could bring an unprecedented fire season, potentially even surpassing the extreme fire season we saw in 2023 in Canada, which was dubbed the year of all records. 2024 was severe, but it was luckily not as catastrophic as anticipated. But it still highlights that there is a shifting baseline of what we consider a normal. So could you speak to what this evolving new normal means to communities in the Arctic and Canada?
Yvonne Jones, Parliamentary Secretary, Canada.
Thank you for the question. It's definitely a new normal in terms of wildfires for us in Canada. And I'll just give you an example. When we say we think it's going to be a worse year or a better year, our standard of measurement is all gauged by 2023 now in Canada, where we had the worst wildfire in our history, destroyed 15 million hectares of land, which is about the size of England. So if you want to put it in perspective, it affected communities, it affected people, businesses, all aspects of life. Actually, this morning I met with the Arctic Economic Council, and one of the members actually is representing Northwest Tell in the Yukon. They had just finished the fiber optic network, the only fiber optic network through the territory, connecting the communities, and they lost the infrastructure, you know, through wildfires. And that all had to replace, so it left people without connectivity for a period of time, but it also destroyed things like the pole lines, so it took out the power for many months. You know, tens, thousands of people were evacuated. Only one highway If you're lucky to have a highway in most Arctic regions, there is one, and that's our case in Canada. So trying to mobilize people, get people out is always very difficult. So it has a tremendous toll on people, community, the economy, the land, every aspect of the environment in which we live. And one thing we've seen in Canada is that, one, fires are burning longer, they are stronger, they're more aggressive. So we're seeing the dynamic of the fire change as well. And when you talk to firefighters, wildland firefighters, they will tell you their approach has had to change because of the aggressive nature of fires, because of the elements of climate is impacting all of that. And so forest fires we would have seen maybe 10 years, 20 years ago are very different wildland fires today. So I think we need to underline that as well. The other thing I've noticed in 2023 for us in Canada is we had tremendous number of evacuations from communities. And you picture this in the Arctic because, you know, we have to travel to main hospital sites. We have to travel outside for all different government services. And often that's by air, not by road for many. What we found was doing things like medevacing patients at hospitals and long-term care facilities and having to do continuous airlifts. In my own riding, you know, we spent a lot of time on that last year as we evacuated two communities, one where the fire came within a couple of kilometers of a 1,000-megawatt hydro development plant that was feeding not just Canadians, but the eastern seaboard, the United States as well. So the impact is not just directly in the communities where this is happening and to people where this is happening. It affects all of us. And it affects the way we do trade, the way we do business, the way we take care of ourselves. And so what we've done in Canada is we've put in place this past year a strategy to deal with wildfires, to help communities build the infrastructure they need, to train the individuals they need, to do better mitigation measures around infrastructure and homes and communities as a whole. So in the last fire this summer in Jasper in Alberta, we lost about 340 pieces of infrastructure, including homes, public buildings. So, you know, it was a tremendous emergency, and it could have been very fatal in many ways. So there's a lot for us to learn, and there's a lot for us to move forward with in terms of changes to really address this issue, which is becoming a larger issue for all of us in the world. But I find that in the Arctic, people in northern areas of Canada, people are being hit harder than any other regions of the country.
That was Yvonne Jones from Canada.
Edward Alexander, I've heard you say on several occasions that you come from the future, that Gwich'in communities have had a front row seat to an Arctic on fire, a precursor for a world on flames. Can you tell us about that future?
You know, I have said that in the past, you know, and for those not familiar, the Yukon Flats are, you know, Gwich'in homelands in Alaska, and we're also in the Yukon Territory and the Northwest Territory. 65% of our homelands have burned just in my lifetime, and we've already reached 9 degrees Fahrenheit of change in my area. And so the 1.5 degrees Celsius of change that we've heard about, we've long since passed that. It's no longer the future. You know, I'm no longer from the future. You're all have caught up with the Gwich'in experience now. And this map is a representation of that. And now we share this common concern, unfortunately. This map represents 430 million acres that have burned in the circumpolar boreal. To put it into context, the circumpolar boreal is the largest terrestrial carbon sink on planet Earth. Underneath this forest lies the permafrost and Yetima that provide the foundation of climate stability for the entire planet. When I say 430 million acres, Christina's right, and it's just a number. What does that number mean? It means an area equivalent to the size of the entire state of Alaska burning plus an entire California burning. And so it becomes very important that we address wildland fire, not just in our local jurisdiction, not just within, not just America, not just Canada, but Russia, Norway, Sweden, Denmark, and so on, Iceland. We have to have circumpolar cooperation to address the circumpolar issue. It's got global climate implications. It's got global health implications. I'm very proud to be a co-lead of the Wildland Fire Initiative with Ambassador Morten Hoglund of Norway. Very excited about Norway's leadership on this issue. The United States as well has been a very strong partner with us in helping to advance knowledge and understanding about what's happening with wildland fire across the circumpolar. But we need to do more. We need to do more. Those of you who are hearing this message, you need to think about to yourself, you know, how can my institution engage with circumpolar wildland fire? How can my government engage on this issue? How can my research engage on this issue? How can I educate others about this issue? It's too important for just the Arctic Council to bring forward. It's too important for just Kwajin to bring forward. And so this represents the collective foundation of our future. It doesn't need to burn. We can work together. We can work together and get the correct solutions in place for this. Cultural burning, which in cultural burning, I feel like is one of those solutions that we can use to limit the severity of wildfire, have mild fire, have decreased severity of wildland fires. We've been honored to share our knowledge with folks and been honored to receive knowledge from the other permanent participants, from the Sami, from Raipan, from the Inuit Circumpolar Council. And hopefully, as we all work together on this issue, we can advance common solutions to this, our most critical common problem.
That was Indigenous leader Edward Alexander from Fort Yukon, Alaska.
And I would like to follow up on that, because I think you have all made it very clear the urgency that is needed and what it means for communities to live through this. But I'd like to bring out those aspects. What is it we can do? What is the actions that are needed, that can be taken to, so we can leave with a sense of it's possible to do something? So I'm throwing that in the round and welcome whoever would like to start to sort of give that perspective of hope, but also of urgency to act.
Senator Murkowski.
Things, if I can just jump in quickly. One of the things that we need to do is we need to value that this wild land is not burning. Because as I've pointed out, the policies that we have had in place in Alaska have been, as long as it doesn't threaten your community, you let it burn. You let Mother Nature take its course. But that is not valuing the opportunity that you have with this extraordinary carbon sink, which is your tundra, your land, your trees. And it's also not fully capturing the level of emissions then that are released when you have permafrost that is then exposed as a result of these fires. So I think we've got to recalibrate how we're valuing. We have to resource appropriately. I mentioned the extent of the funding that comes specifically to Alaska versus the rest of the country. But I think we also have to focus on some of the data and the research gaps that exist. There's great science is going on. There's a pilot project that was just entered into where they're doing within a very targeted area within the Yukon Flats Wildlife Refuge area, where there's going to be a immediate response. And when I say immediate response, you get on the fire within 48 hours to try to put it out, regardless of where it is within that area and whether or not there's threat to property. It's small. It's a small initiative. But I think it's causing us to think about how are we valuing keeping intact our permafrost, keeping intact these ecosystems.
Maria, the state secretary from Norway.
To connect to the point of Senator Murkowski, keeping intact ecosystems is crucial to solve the big climate challenge. So I believe that building bridges between indigenous knowledge, scientific knowledge, but also connecting the impacts of climate change on the Arctic region to the broader climate agenda within the framework of the UNFCCC, the climate COPs. Because what we're talking about here is connected to the big picture and the issue of adaptation, mitigation, loss and damage, and financing. Those are the four pillars of the climate COP UNFCCC work. And so by connecting the knowledge produced by the Arctic Council to the big platform that gathers more and more world leaders, which the climate COPs do, we can increase the effort to combat the drivers behind these changes, which are man-made climate emissions, due to the fact that our energy systems have for too long been dependent on fossil fuels, and we need to transition away from that. So, and also to the point of permafrost thawing, it releases methane, which is a super potent climate greenhouse gas, which is much more dangerous than CO2. So those four pillars need to be implemented.
Yvonne Jones, Canada.
I agree with what they both said. I really believe that we need to really adapt to different strategies, you know, and we have the same policy in Canada as well, Senator, where we only tackle fires when they're within a certain distance of communities, major infrastructure, and so on. What we're finding is that these fires are spreading faster. And we are seeing sometimes, you know, they can bridge 8 to 10 kilometers in a few hours. So, you know, preparedness is essential. And I think learning from each other, you know, mitigation techniques that we can implement and looking at how we can work closer together towards training and the infrastructure capacity that's needed right across the Arctic countries to be able to tackle these kinds of changes with wildland fires. But I think the role we all have is to continue to push forward with strong climate agenda and educating countries about what's happening in the Arctic.
Yes,
because I don't think we're doing enough. They're not realizing that people here are actually losing everything they own to wildland fires. And it's all happening because of the shift in climate that we're seeing. So I think we need to do more, whether it's through Arctic Circle, whether it's through other groups, organizations, partnerships with countries, indigenous governments, and so on, to continue with strong education around the world of how this is impacting us, because we have many friends and neighbors that can do more as well. We can do more ourselves. And we need to do more. So I think if there's a strategy that we could work together on collectively that requires very little, it would be that, for sure.
So there's a need for more fora to raise this. The UNFCCC was mentioned. The Wildland Fire Initiative is bringing wildland fires to Baku, to COP29. And the topic is on cultural burning. And Edward Alexander, sort of the closing minutes we have here, if you briefly could speak about sort of the climate mitigation that's inherent in indigenous cultural burning practices.
Edward Alexander.
Yeah, sure. Well, I couldn't agree more with all the interventions made. You know, it's... And I think Senator Murkowski is absolutely right. The let burn policy is one that's failed. I think one of the things we need to think about when we think about protecting infrastructure and that thought process around wildland fire is some of the most important infrastructure globally in the Arctic is protecting the carbon sink that is permafrost and Yetima, and especially Yetima. And if you haven't learned about that issue, I think it's very integrally tied to Gwich'in policy on wildland fire. Our chiefs have passed resolutions about cultural burning, adopting cultural burning as a way to protect Yetima. Yetima is a huge source of methane, but it's also a huge source of nitrous oxide. And so methane's like something like 30 times more powerful than CO2, and then nitrous oxide something like 250 times more powerful than CO2. And the Yetima structures in the north contain many, many, many more times the amount of climate-changing gases than have ever been released by humanity since industrialization. And so it's very important that we adopt measures like cultural burning, which can help to restore the carbon cycle in these systems, help to store carbon back into the soil. We do it during the springtime when there's still snow in the forest. This is a natural fire break, and the grass burns, and so then the fire doesn't spread out into the land. And it also doesn't burn down into the soil because it's frozen, and helps to restore the system, increases biodiversity, increases safety for communities, decreases wildland fire smoke and other things. And so we feel it's a key issue. Our chiefs have spoken quite plainly on the topic for the need to have a national policy on Yetamo. But it's not enough if the United States has a national policy on wildland fire in Yetamo. We also need Russia to have a national policy on Yetamo and wildland fire. And we also need Canada to have a national policy on. And this is the areas that we really need to work together on. Cooperation, you know, this is key.
You just heard Edward Alexander, co-chair of the Aboriginal Gwich'in Council International, with populations in both Canada and the United States. That concludes our time with the NGO Arctic Circle panel.
Thank you to Arctic Circle for this panel recorded in Reykjavik, Iceland at the Arctic Circle Assembly October 17th to 19th, 2024. The panel is available on YouTube, along with at least a dozen other presentations. Find links in my show blog at ecoshock.org or go to arcticcircle.org.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog, ecoshock.org.
There are two relatively new threats to all of us raised in this panel. First, Lisa Murkowski points to an important underestimation about the impact of increasing wildfires in the Arctic. When boreal forests burn down, that exposes frozen ground, the permafrost, directly to the sun's energy, and that includes during long summer days of nonstop heating. In nature, the permafrost melts more slowly when it is shaded. Lisa cites black spruce forests as good protectors of permafrost. When they burn, the next vegetation, probably just shrubs, growing up, but does not offer the same shade. Black spruce may take much more than a decade to regain dominance. Meanwhile, one of the largest carbon lockers in the world is exposed to more thawing. As microorganisms get to work, they release methane if they are under a pond, or carbon dioxide if on the land in the open air. This is already happening, but it will speed up even more with wildfires. Current models do not contain this change in permafrost or the atmosphere, as massive fires burn all around the Arctic Ocean. Second, Edward Alexander twice raises another special form of frozen carbon, Yadoma. This is a new word for many listeners, Y-E-D-O-M-A. In Siberia, Alaska, and Canada hold huge slabs of prehistoric ice, part of the landscape. They are mostly water, but as Alexander tells us, these in-ground ice fields contain more carbon than humans can produce. The Yadoma looks almost like dark rock in places where it is exposed, or blue ice, along the Arctic riverbeds with ocean coastal cliffs as well. But this geology can change pretty quickly because it can thaw. That leaves soggy bogs, pockmarked with small lakes, collapsing landscapes. Earth has more than 1 million square kilometers of Yadoma in the Arctic. Yadoma formations need protection, if that is possible. They certainly need to be monitored. For example, if Yadoma starts releasing more greenhouse gases, then humans must emit far less. Otherwise, a positive feedback kicks in where more Yadoma leads to more warming, which leads to more Yadoma thaw. Of course, the only answer is to drastically slash greenhouse gas emissions starting now. That protects the Arctic from even more wildfires and thawing carbon from permafrost and Yadomas. It is a bit surprising, or not, to hear the State Secretary of the Norwegian Ministry of Foreign Affairs admit we know what causes all of this. It is humans burning fossil fuels, and that needs to be reduced. The irony is, the Norwegian government owns and runs one of the larger fossil fuel operations in the world. It is the 13th largest oil producer in the world and 7th largest gas producer. Norwegians as a whole are raking in hundreds of billions of dollars more now that Russian sanctions have raised energy prices in Europe, Norway's major market. Norway acknowledges burning fossil fuels causes global warming. They promise to achieve carbon neutrality by 2030 and a low-emission society, whatever that means, by 2050. But this is disingenuous. This is just to fool people. They could transition entirely with their $1.5 trillion national oil fund from fossil fuel sales. Like Canada, Norway promises to reduce greenhouse gas emissions from their production platforms and facilities. Well, that's great, but they don't count emissions when their products are sold and burned in other parts of the world. They don't talk about cutting back their exports and production. To save a livable climate, both countries need to announce their 5-year wind-down plan to stop selling fossil fuels. There is no other magic answer. Physical systems don't care about promises, ideas, or excuses. So like everyone else, the Norwegian government knows its products are killing millions of people worldwide with much more damage, death, and displacement to come. But they are making way too much money to actually stop. Now, with the Ukraine war energy crisis, the government of Norway can claim the high ground. They are keeping Europe's economy going and preventing people from freezing in their gas-dependent homes. Norwegian gas also brings them extreme flash floods to wash those homes away. Canada and the United States do the same. Even Saudi Arabia knows climate change is real and not good for them, not good at all in coming decades. Yet they profit and profit from more oil production. The Saudis, too, claim to be supporting people everywhere who need it. They're just helpful. Fossil fuel production is portrayed as a service to a needy and grateful public. I guess the contradiction in the Norwegian representative at the Arctic Circle should be no surprise. Norway currently holds the chairmanship of the Arctic Circle and keeps it until Denmark takes over in 2025. Finally, the circle will be run by a wind producer instead of fossil fuel producers. Why not Russia? They apparently withdrew after the invasion of Ukraine. At the time of the invasion, Russia was the chair of the Arctic Council, but they were ostracized. Somehow the Norwegians regain the chair position and conferences go on without Russia, but scientific research into Arctic matters seems locked up in a geopolitical deep freeze, just when we need it most. It gets worse. Well, of course it gets worse. Further up the political food chain, the only semblance of pan-Arctic governance has fallen into a coma. Unlike the wide-open Arctic Circle, who produced our panel, the Arctic Council is a different beast. Not circle, council. The Arctic Council has only 8 countries with a speaking role: Canada, Denmark, Finland, Iceland, Norway, Russia, Sweden, and the United States. This is where governments came to make deals and discuss common problems. As the Arctic heated up 4 times the global average, and sea ice continues its retreat, the previous Trump administration, from 2017, worked to neutralize the Arctic Council. They wanted the words climate change and the like removed from joint documents. The United States shut down any climate or energy discussions. Trump floated the idea of buying Greenland. Expect more of the same from 2025 onward. On the other side of the polar sea, Russia has been shut out of the Arctic Council. 53%, more than half, of the Arctic coastline is claimed by Russia. That country has more Arctic land, settlements, people, and military bases than all others. Without Russia, there is no way forward for agreements to protect permafrost, the ice world, and all the fragile creatures of the far north. Meanwhile, China claims it is a near-polar state, with serious claims to the Arctic. At least twice, Chinese interests attempted to buy Arctic ports for dual civilian-military use. Chinese scientists have an Arctic study base and produced a lot of new research recently about the poles, from undersea geology to climate change. Norway, Iceland, and Denmark, they mean well, and they are trying to keep the Arctic Circle and the Arctic Council alive. But without Russia and America in there to stall everything, for now the Arctic Council is dead. In its place comes a militarized competition for whatever oil, gas, or minerals lie beneath the untapped Arctic Ocean. You can watch YouTube videos of Russia's ambitious bases, very creative, big investments, ports, strategies for military control of the far north. Russia also has a fleet of the world's only atomic-powered icebreakers up there. The Arctic is home to Russia's primary nuclear ballistic missile submarine force. The United States, they have the Joint Air Force and Army Base Elmendorf-Richardson near Anchorage, Alaska. There's Fort Wainwright and Fort Greely near Fairbanks, and the Eielson Air Force Base near the North Pole, I suppose. American nuclear submarines are known to travel under the ice. The previous Trump administration considered the Arctic a place of strategic struggle rather than a cooperation zone. All this is to say there is a wild north as lawless as the legendary Wild West of America. The fires are also wild. According to the EU Copernicus Project, if our emissions hit a medium to high emissions scenario, terrifying fire years like the 2023 in Canada will happen 6 to 10 times more frequently by the end of the century. That will be the new norm, or worse. Fire carbon emissions were up 16% in 2023. So that's part of the record heating we're already experiencing. We do not know for sure how much even burned. There isn't enough globally sifted data on wildfires. Russia does not report reliable figures. Canada may not know for sure. We know there were giant wildfires in the Canadian Arctic Circle in August 2024. All-time record high temperatures were recorded in August, with parts of the Arctic Circle reaching 36 degrees C, 97 degrees Fahrenheit. That doesn't happen. In some areas of the Northwest Territories, fires burned over 100,000 hectares of land per day. I was unable to find figures for all wildfires in the Arctic Circle in 2023 and 24. We do not know how big this problem is or how fast it is getting worse. None of them thought that institutions would fail, leaving no one at the helm. The failure of the Arctic institutions of cooperation are just part of gross institutional breakdown as the climate crisis deepens. Likewise, the convention of the parties or the COP meetings, that's floundering. For a second year, it is being run by oil and gas producers with more oil-related lobbyists than nonprofits in attendance. There's no chance for civil protests or outside voices. It's in a very authoritative state in a distant place. This is all while global emissions hit absolute new record highs and wild profits drive oil multinationals to ditch their green promises and drill, drill, drill. Enter Donald Trump, the president of Drill, Drill, Drill Incorporated. As far as I know, there is no plan forward after widespread institutional failure. Without international cooperation and legitimate governments supported by their population, there is no way to stop global climate change. The United Nations failed decades ago. There is currently no institution or meaningful organization to lead global action for a safe environment. Perhaps a miracle will happen. Maybe, maybe, maybe. No one knows the future. I don't. That is what we have, a world of trouble, and some flimsy maybes. The next plot twist awaits us. Hopefully, it is not the end of the series. I'm Alex, with new facts and mad rambles. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.
In your tracks of Arctic flakes.